Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm Carol Van Dam in Washington.
And I'm Ayan Bior, also in Washington. Here are some of the stories we're covering today, Monday, January 11th, 2016. President Kiir says he's energized by last week's SPLM party convention.
These five outcomes of this extraordinary convention have given me new energy and dedication to serve our people with the knowledge that I have a solid support from you.
And at least one analyst says the SPLM reunification effort is aimed at separating the party's military and political wings.
The reunification agreement is attempting to separate the two, which is why the conflict got to where it is at the moment, because the line between the army and politics were too close.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus.
President Salva Kiir says the reunification of the SPLM party is now complete and there will no longer be any more party factions after last week's convention incorporated the Arusha Reunification Agreement into the party's constitution. Philip Thon Oleu has more from Juba.
Speaking on Saturday at the close of the SPLM convention, President Kiir said the party's reunification has given him new energy to lead the party and the country.
Yesterday when we were here, some members were questioning why this new Arusha agreement was being incorporated into our constitution. And that was not an easy question. But here it has been done. That new, we said, no, this was the source of our reunification.
Mr. Kiir says incorporating the Arusha agreement into the SPLM constitution marks the end of a fractionalized SPLM. The SPLM convention also passed the party manifesto, a new party flag, and endorsed red as the SPLM color. President Kiir says the unity shown at the convention by party delegates gives him confidence that he enjoys the support of all members.
These five outcomes of this extraordinary convention have given me new energy, inspiration, and dedication to serve our people with the knowledge that I have a solid support from you.
SPLM in opposition lead negotiator Taban Dengai says more must be done before the SPLM is formally reunited. Speaking to reporters after the closing session, he said the SPLM in opposition did not take part in the extraordinary convention.
We did not participate in passing this constitution. So we don't know what it is that. But they have told us that they have incorporated a Russia agreement in totality. We are not sure of this. We shall take the constitution that they have passed. We go and study it. And then we shall communicate with them. Because to us, the process is not yet completed.
Guy says the convention should have been delayed until SPLM in opposition leader Riek Machar arrives in Juba, so he could have participated in the meeting. SPLM officials in Juba say registration for political parties expires this week as stipulated by the 2012 Political Parties Act, so therefore it was necessary to meet last week. The Arusha SPLM reunification agreement also states that there will be secret voting as opposed to a show of hands during SPLM elections, and President Kiir will no longer appoint 5% of the delegates. For VOA News, I am Philip Tonaleo in Juba.
The reunification of the SPLM has wide-ranging implications on peace and stability in South Sudan, according to the senior policy analyst at the Juba-based Sud Institute. Zechariah Dingal-Kohl says one focus in the reunification agreement is separating the political wing of the party, the SPLM, from its military side, the SPLA. Akol says this move will help stabilize the country because it will allow more efforts to go into developing the country's infrastructure rather than spending money on politics.
An SPLM and SPLA, now the South Sudanese Army, are closely related. And the reunification agreement is attempting to separate the two, which is why the conflict got to where it is at the moment, because the line between the army and politics were too close. So the peace agreement, which is attempting to end the conflict, cannot really usher in South Sudan in an era of peace and stability when the future of the SPLM is not settled.
Now, President Kiir says that the reunification of the party has reinvigorated him. Is the SPLM Extraordinary Convention, is that more of a symbolic event, or is it capable of making actual changes within the party?
Well, it is a first step towards that, but that is not the we are not at the last stage of the process. This is just the beginning. As I understand it, the focus of the convention was to pass the basic documents, which were passed, you know, in the lead up to the conflict itself in 2013 on the 14th and the 15th of December, the night, you know, the same night when the meetings, the convention concluded that, you know, violence erupted. So this is the first step, but I think it is an important step. But it is important also to note that the factions of the SPLM are not on the same page with this one. So the clear test lies ahead in the next coming days and weeks and perhaps months to see what will become of the reunification process.
How would you describe the feelings of South Sudanese towards the SPLM?
People are bitter, and understandably so. But people also recognize the fact that SPLM is what it is. South Sudan is the difference between the country and the SPLM at the moment in South Sudan is very minimal. SPLM occupies a special place in the South Sudanese political psyche. So people know, although they are bitter about the SPLM, they are not necessarily bitter about the party. The SPLM as a party, or as it started out as a movement and then transformed itself into a party, people understand it, and it has visions that people buy into. But people are bitter about the leaders and the way the leaders fail to manage understandable differences and conflicts and dynamics, and they enable the situation to degenerate into violence.
Now, with the culmination of conflict and political tension the last couple of years, what is your analysis of the SPLM moving forward? Is the SPLM capable of reuniting under one political umbrella?
The answer, in all honesty, can be both yes and no. Yes, if there is a willingness and commitment on the part of the parties, the three factions of the SPLM to come together. No, if the parties are still fixated on the power struggle and trying to outwit the other. So it's difficult, but I see the reunification as very fundamental to the overall peace and stability in South Sudan. The leadership of the SPLM in all the three factions, I hope, has learned its lesson. And also the South Sudanese, I hope, would have seen how important the unity of the SPLM as a party is.
That was the Sud Institute's Zechariah Dingakol speaking to me earlier from Maine.
Patients, including premature babies, reportedly have died at Juba Teaching Hospital over the past month because the hospital cannot afford fuel to run its generators. About 10 patients died since early December, according to the Associated Press, because doctors could not perform surgery on them without electricity or give them special machines. The AP report said they include premature babies who needed oxygen provided through electricity-powered cylinders. The AP talked to an unnamed hospital official who insisted on anonymity. We spoke to Dr. John Chol, Director General of the Juba Teaching Hospital, who declined to speak on the record but advised us to contact the Minister of Health instead. We have been unable to get in touch with the Minister of Health. The Associated Press reports the facility has put most surgical operations on hold after the national currency devalued sharply, raising the cost of fuel last month to 4,400 South Sudanese pounds from 1,200 South Sudanese pounds per 200 to 250 liter drum, which continues today. Since Christmas Eve, the hospital's maternity and prenatal wards and some other services resumed operations after President Kiir donated fuel to the hospital. Dr. Chol told the AP that would last about 1 month for the maternity and prenatal wards. The Ministry of Health told iRadio today that it has directed Nile Petroleum Company to supply fuel to Juba Teaching Hospital. The state oil company raised fuel prices after the country's central bank removed a fixed exchange rate in mid-December, allowing market forces to determine the pound's value against the dollar. The government action was taken in an effort to curb inflation in the country.
You're tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. A doping scandal in Kenya. More on that when we come back.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
what can be done to improve crop production in your region?
Okay, to improve crop production, we need funding, and then the farmers, they need to be sensitized and trained for better ways of planting crops or trees for fruits.
Introducing irrigation systems. As we know, we're living in the dry season and the rains are not frequently falling. So the irrigation systems can help farmers to grow the recommended crops they need.
To improve crop production in my region, the farmers should be practicing crop rotation. For example, this season, they should either cultivate maize and the next season, soya. Like the soya provide nutrients to the soil.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus. As the birthplace and training ground of many of the world's finest middle and long-distance runners, Kenya has recently been shaken by news that several of its athletes failed drug tests, leading to their suspensions. Jill Craig reports from Nairobi that there are accusations Nairobi's Athletics Federation is not doing enough to tackle doping or graft.
A country known for producing some of the world's premier distance runners has recently found itself in the spotlight for the use of illegal performance-enhancing drugs. The International Association of Athletics Federations announced in November it has been investigating Kenya since March for allegations of covering up doping. 24-year-old Samuel Jaguna is a Kenyan pole vaulter and marathoner. He says it is not good that some of his fellow athletes have been involved in the scandal.
Maybe you may come number one, but it's not a perfect. It's not fair to others because... can you imagine I'm working hard to work on that and someone is using drugs? It's discouraging.
Kenya banned seven athletes in November for doping offenses, raising the number of drug cases to 40 in the past 3 years. This includes two female sprinters sent home from the recent World Championships in Beijing. Retired General Jackson Tuwe is the acting president of Athletics Kenya, the country's national association. He says in all local and international competitions, athletes are tested for doping in what he calls a very elaborate exercise.
Let me say very clearly that it's not a systemic problem. I think these are purely individual problems. And we want to say that it's a small proportion, but we, of course, would like to have nothing of that.
Tuwe is acting president of Athletics Kenya because the IAAF provisionally suspended three senior Kenyan athletics officials for 180 days. The officials are accused of subverting the anti-doping control process in Kenya and the improper diversion of funds received from Nike through a sponsorship deal. Jaguna says these allegations tarnish Kenya's athletic reputation.
Which also diminishes in our country, and you know our country is the first from the world with athletics. And it's not good because it also has some not good image. The image is not good for our country.
The International Olympic Committee asked Kenya's Olympic Committee, as well as the World Anti-Doping Agency, to ensure an efficient out-of-competition testing program for athletes in all sports. In November, the Kenyan government set up a national anti-doping organization and gave it the authority to carry out tests and prosecute cases. Tuwe says Athletics Kenya does not have the power or capacity to investigate or prosecute, so he is pleased the government set up this new agency.
And so we are working very closely. We're very, very closely with that team. And we believe that we are going to make very good progress.
In a statement provided to VOA, the World Anti-Doping Agency said it is assisting with the development of the Kenyan anti-doping program. It said that while progress has been made, there is still a lot of work required. The agency said it is waiting for concrete plans from the government to fund and finalize the anti-doping rules. Jill Craig, VOA News, Nairobi.
A Democratic Republic of Congo official says the country is taking seriously allegations that several of its soldiers deployed as peacekeepers in the Central African Republic committed rape. The United Nations says the DRC battalion and the CAR will be withdrawn and not replaced. For VOA, Nick Longfiles from Goma in eastern DRC.
The Democratic Republic of Congo has a battalion of about 800 soldiers and 123 police officers with the UN mission in the Central African Republic, known as MINUSCA. Last August, three soldiers in that battalion were accused of raping three female civilians, including one minor. The DRC Justice Minister said at the time the allegations would be investigated. This month, the UN said it is investigating new allegations of sexual abuse of minors by peacekeepers. It is not clear how important the rape allegations are in the UN decision the DRC troops should withdraw from the Central African Republic. UN officials have said the troops failed an internal assessment based on equipment, vetting procedures and preparedness. But in an interview with VOA, the DRC president's personal representative charged with the fight against sexual violence, Janine Mabunda Lioko Mudiai, linked the decision to the allegations. Mabunda says the DRC was informed by the United Nations that a decision had been taken on the withdrawal of the DRC contingent from MINUSCA following rape allegations against certain soldiers in that unit. She says the DRC has taken strong measures in recent months in response to those allegations. She says the DRC brought 20 soldiers back to Kinshasa. Their cases are being examined, and the 20 are at the Ndolo military prison, she says, adding that this shows how seriously the DRC regards questions of violence against women, particularly where security forces are concerned. VOA asked what stage has been reached in the inquiry into the rape allegations. Mabunda says the process is ongoing and must go through stages. We must not put on a show trial, she says. The rights of defendants must not be trampled on, although certainly these are atrocious, ignoble charges. The DRC's justice system can be trusted, Mabunda insists. Since her bureau was created 18 months ago, she says, the DRC's institutions have shown they are capable of striking hard when rape cases are brought before them and when those cases are proved. A number of DRC soldiers have been convicted of sexual offences in the past 18 months, including a general and a colonel. Nick Long for VOA News, Goma.
The number of Burundi refugees is on the rise. More people are crossing into neighboring countries as tensions remain high in the country and peace talks fail to start. Karen de Gruel is a spokesperson for the UN Refugee Agency, the UNHCR. From Geneva, she spoke to VOA's Joe DiCapua about the Burundi refugee situation.
Since the beginning of April, when the unrest began, 236,000 people have fled the country. That's nearly a quarter of a million people over the last couple of months. And they're mostly in Tanzania, Rwanda, and the DRC, with some smaller numbers in Zambia and Uganda as well. And we still see people leaving the country, although not as in such big numbers as we saw over the summer months. But people are still leaving, and they're using mostly the non-official border crossings because they have been stopped. And we've received reports of people not being able to cross.
And is UNHCR meeting them at the unofficial border crossings?
We have possibilities of, in some of the countries, we meet them. There are transit centers where they come, and then from there, they're being moved to the refugee camp.
What are the conditions like now in the refugee camps?
In Tanzania, where we had the biggest problems and where we have the largest number of refugees, more than 125,000, the situation has improved. With the opening of the new camp in early October, we managed to relocate 40,000 people to Nduta camp, which has taken off a bit of pressure, but the main camp in Tanzania remains overcrowded and needs further improvement. We're opening two other camps as well in Tanzania, which should alleviate the pressure even further. And of course, in case it's necessary, they will also be prepared if more people are crossing the border.
Now, as you know, the Burundi government has made accusations that various rebel groups are recruiting members in the refugee camps. Has UNHCR responded to those allegations?
We've heard these allegations. We have also these allegations mainly in Rwanda, but also in some of the other countries. And as you know, it's the government, the hosting government, that is in charge of maintaining the civilian character of the camps. And if there are reports of recruitment, to investigate and to stop them. So we're working with the governments, in particularly in Rwanda, to investigate these allegations and taking preventive measures. Big part of that is also sensitizing the refugees that they also should respect the civilian character of the camp. There can be no recruitment in these camps.
Has UNHCR made any long-term plans for 2016, since it doesn't look like this Burundi situation is going to end anytime soon?
Yes, we do. We are prepared with our partners. We have made contingency planning for 100,000 additional arrivals during 2016. But we're also very much aware that these people can come in a very much shorter period of time. So it's a two-track process. One of our biggest problems is, and it will not surprise you since we've talked about this before, is the funding issue. In 2015, our program was only 38% funding, leaving a 62% gap. So if the numbers are increasing, and if the numbers are increasing rapidly, the situation will be even more serious, and the lack of funding will have its implications.
Karen De Kruel is a spokesperson for the UN Refugee Agency, the UNHCR. From Geneva, she spoke to VOA's Joe DiCapua.
Meanwhile, Malawi continues receiving hundreds of refugees from Mozambique, 6 months after RENAMO fighters carried out two attacks in Tet province. The fighting in July forced more than 700 people into Malawi, and refugees say they continue to flee atrocities and killings by militias. Lamech Messina reports for VOA from a refugee camp in Malawi's Mwanza district, home to more than 2,500 refugees who fled atrocities in the Tet province.
Refugees are entering daily at the newly established Kabisa 2 refugee camp in southern Malawi. They tell stories about people they believe are Frelimo government fighters torching their houses and killing their relatives on suspicion of hosting RENAMO fighters. Flora Emerson is one of them. She says his uncle's son was shot dead just a few meters from where she was. And when she rushed to see what had happened, he could not speak and was almost dead. I did not hesitate, she says, but ran away for safety. Camp supervisors say they register almost 40 refugees a day, many women and children. Camp residents say they have not received food aid since mid-December. One of the refugees, Elena Limited, says life is tough. She says they do not have clothes, blankets and food. Although they are constructing makeshift shelters, they do not have any protection from the rains, and their fear is that it will be another trouble when the rains come. Many survive by working in nearby maize gardens or turning maize husks into flour for cooking porridge. But the refugee influx worries villagers near the camp. William Mitiwe is the headman at Kabise 2 village. He says although they are staying with these people in the village, they are living in fear because they believe that if they will completely run out of food, they will start stealing from them in their homes. The villagers also fear some of the refugees might have run with weapons that can be used against them. Mozambican authorities reportedly said those fleeing into Malawi are either thugs or lazy people. But refugee Jarel Bernardo denies this. He says the government cannot say they are lazy people who are leaving Mozambique for free things at a refugee camp in Malawi. He says here at the camp are all sorts of people, including children, adults and the aged. And the government can't say it has been feeding them all this time. Malawi government authorities say they are trying to work with their Mozambican counterparts on how best to address the issue. Meanwhile, international bodies are helping out. Doctors Without Borders is providing medical help. The United Nations has provided some tents and has established a children's counseling center where children also sing songs to help relieve them from trauma due to running away from home. Malawi previously hosted Mozambicans who fled a 16-year civil war between 1977 and 1992. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Mwanza, Malawi.
Here is a recap of today's top stories. President Salva Kiir says the reunification of the ruling SPLM party is now complete, and there will no longer be different party factions after last week's convention in Juba. The party incorporated the Arusha Reunification Agreement into the party's constitution. Speaking Saturday at the close of the convention, President Kiir said the party's reunification has given him new energy to lead the party and the country. The SPLM convention also passed the party's manifesto, a new party flag, and endorsed red as the SPLM's color. But SPLM in opposition lead negotiator Taban Dengai says more must be done before the SPLM is formally reunited. Speaking to reporters after the closing session, he said the SPLM IO did not take part in the convention, and he says we did not participate in passing this constitution, so we don't know what is there. They have told us that they have incorporated the Arusha Agreement. We are not sure of this, end quote. He says as far as the SPLM IO is concerned, the reunification is not completed yet. The deadline to register political parties is this week in South Sudan. The reunification of the party has wide-ranging implications on peace and stability in South Sudan, according to the senior policy analyst at the Juba-based Sud Institute. Zachariah Ding Akol says the reunification deal is aimed at separating the political wing of the party, the SPLM, from its military side, the SPLA. Akol says this move will help stabilize the country because it will allow more efforts to go into developing the country's infrastructure rather than spending money on politics. He says the reunification of the country will, in some cases, depend on the reunification of the party. And finally, patients, including premature babies, have reportedly died at Juba Teaching Hospital because the hospital cannot afford fuel to run its generators. That, according to various media reports, the Associated Press reported on Friday that about 10 patients died since early December because doctors could not perform surgery or get them certain machines without electricity. They include premature babies who needed oxygen provided through electricity-powered cylinders. That's according to a hospital official who insisted on anonymity. We spoke to Dr. John Chol, Director General of Juba Teaching Hospital, who would not speak on the record but did advise us to contact the Minister of Health. We were unable to get in touch with the Minister of Health. The Associated Press reports the facility has put most surgical operations on hold after the national currency devalued sharply. The Ministry of Health told iRadio today that it has directed Nile Petroleum Company to supply fuel to Juba Teaching Hospital. That's a look at today's top stories, and that's our show for this Monday. We leave you with the song Surayako by Saudi Soul.
We've been listening to Sauti Sol with the song Surayako. I'm Ayan Bior in Washington.
And I'm Carol Van Dam in Washington. Thanks for listening. We'll see you back here tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from The Voice of America.
Mombasa.